You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
In the communications sector, there is a revolution taking place.
Look how far we've come. A third of the music released last year in this country was not even released on a CD.
Do you use a credit card online?
Oh, no. I live in Russia.
I'm concerned about the way the company's being run and the fiber to the node network.
Unless we can have clarity that we will not be subjected to further separation, we are not in a position to lodge an RFP bid.
You can't make it a technical game because the very people you're trying to protect are smarter than you.
We want to really change the world by making things so special, you've got to have it.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Just when we thought any deals and partnerships between Microsoft and Yahoo were dead in the water, a deal has surfaced this week of an online advertising deal between the two giants. Microsoft has been left at the altar on many occasions now when it comes to joint ventures with internet companies and even its own endeavours when it comes to being an online provider. It was reported in All Things Digital this week that as part of the pending deal, in which Yahoo would sell search advertising for its site and some of Microsoft's, while Microsoft Bing search technology would power it, Yahoo would get to keep pretty much all of the revenue, and even more for the next 3 years. Sources said that in the first 2 years of the deal, Yahoo would get to keep 110% of all revenue. And in the third, Yahoo would get 90%, which could represent many billions of dollars, since Yahoo will be selling for both. For Microsoft, the payment will, within 4 years, allow the software giant to become the de facto number two search technology player after Google. It is not clear if there have been any guarantees on revenue made by Microsoft, but there are no upfront payments being made to the Silicon Valley-based Yahoo. If Microsoft is happy to play second fiddle to Google, maybe this is a good solution. But the reality is that Microsoft has missed the internet ship, and not only by a few minutes, by almost a decade. Microsoft was a 90s company, and Google was a millennium company, and is now even a larger threat to Microsoft with its move into the operating system marketplace, especially since the announcement of the Chrome operating system destined for netbooks and the like. So while Microsoft try and sell their operating system, Google are quite happy providing it as freeware. The future of operating systems is becoming clear: low cost, lightweight, and open. So, is there room for two major players in the marketplace? Three, if you count Apple. Only history will tell.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
Adam Turner turns his attention to video games. What's your addiction? A quick fix? Or do you settle in for the long haul? Microsoft and Yahoo are at it again. If it's not a personal question, how big is it? The internet, that is. And Google tweaked Gmail to make it more appealing to business users. First up, though, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk with Dr. Ron.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, security giant McAfee issues a public apology. Alcatel-Lucent is building a new cable to New Zealand. 20 new channels and video on demand for Ozstar. The space shuttle Endeavour returns safely to Earth. And Jerusalem's Wailing Wall is now plugged into Twitter. Welcome to Tech Talk News. US-based security specialist McAfee issued a public apology last week after the company sent the personal contact details of over 1,400 security professionals attached to a bulk email. McAfee blamed the mistake on human error. The attachment, a contact list for McAfee's strategic security summit held 2 weeks ago in Sydney, was mistakenly attached to a promotional email sent to conference delegates and contained delegates' names, phone numbers, email addresses, employment details, and even dietary requirements. But McAfee said that while the email attachment included, quote, common conference registration information, it didn't include any of the delegates' financial details. A Sydney-based spokeswoman for McAfee told IT Wire last week that the company was not sure how many people received the contact details, but that the company had done everything it could to identify recipients and to request that they delete the information. McAfee had contacted all people affected by the mistake to inform them of the extent of the security breach. Alcatel-Lucent has announced that it's won a contract to build an 8,000-kilometre submarine cable network linking New Zealand to existing Australian infrastructure. The project will link New Caledonia, French Polynesia, Norfolk Island and New Zealand to existing internet infrastructure and will provide an alternative trans-Tasman internet backbone. The network will also link to other submarine cable networks, such as the Gondwana system linking Noumea to Sydney. Two segments will each have a maximum capacity of 640 gigabits per second. The first segment will connect Noumea in New Caledonia to Tahiti in French Polynesia, with landing points in Vanuatu, Wallace, Samoa, and American Samoa. The second segment will link Noumea to Auckland, with a landing point in Norfolk Island. ITY reported last week that there are only two systems which presently provide trans-Tasman links, Southern Cross and the ageing Tasman 2, which has minimal capacity. While Southern Cross provides a fully redundant route, it does so via Hawaii, which adds significant latency. The South Pacific Island Network, or SPIN, is a working group which includes 12 Pacific Island countries and territories, and has been planning the cable network for some years. SPIN launched an international open tender for supply and construction of the system in June last year. Regional pay TV operator Ozstar announced a major marketing push last week. The campaign will promote the launch of more than 20 new channels, more interactive services including video on demand, and a new high-definition set-top box. Ozstar also appears to be planning a free online catch-up TV service by next year, enabling its customers to view programs they've missed or forgotten to record. Australian IT News said that Ozstar had reported a net profit after tax of $35.5 million for the 6 months to June, which is up from a $7.6 million loss in the previous comparable period. Ozstar's chief executive, Mr. John Porter, said the good results were owing to a turnaround in consumer sentiment and some positive impact from the federal government's economic stimulus program. Australian IT News said the strong half-year results came despite the impact of the Victorian bushfires and the floods in Queensland, both of which had a negative effect on sales in the first quarter of this year. The Space Shuttle Endeavour and its seven astronauts returned safely to Earth last week, landing at Florida's Kennedy Space Center on Friday morning. The 16-day mission saw the shuttle crew complete all major construction goals at the International Space Station. Japanese astronaut Koichi Wakata also returned after 4.5 months in space, and the Associated Press reported that he couldn't wait to eat some sushi and see his wife and son. Enhancements were made to the Japanese Space Station laboratory during Endeavour's visit, and the crew also installed fresh batteries and stockpiled spare parts. Endeavour's astronauts were also forced to contend with a flooded toilet and an overheated air purifier. And one of the world's most ancient religious sites is now connected to cyberspace. Jewish pilgrims who have traditionally prayed at the Western or Wailing Wall in Old Jerusalem can now tweet their prayers via Twitter. The prayers are printed and then delivered to the wall in Jerusalem. The site's founder, Mr. Elon Neil, told ABC Radio last week that he'd been overwhelmed with thousands of prayers from around the globe.
The beautiful thing about Twitter is that I think that now there are maybe 60 or 70 million users, and there's nothing easier to tweet a prayer, to send a message via Twitter. It's easier and faster than email or any other form of communication, and it's definitely much easier than to hop on a plane and come to Israel and stash the note yourself in the Western Wall.
While hundreds and potentially thousands of people visit the Wailing Wall every day, Mr. Neil says he's been swamped by the massive demand for his Twitter-based prayer service. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
I've been to CMFT. I bought a brand new studio monitor.
Tech Talk Radio encourages responsible downloading and viewing of television and copyright content.
That's not going to cut it on a movie screen.
So we've now got someone steering the ship. He's boarded the SSNBN.
I liked your tweet pics. They were impressive.
That's right.
Are they going to be using some form of unidirectional aerial?
The tram drivers like leaning on that bell thing that they've got. Have you noticed?
You haven't got a ding-ding sound effect there.
I'm fresh out of ding-ding sound effects.
Yeah, tell everybody what LEM stands for.
That's the scary thing with keeping everything in the cloud, is that you don't quite know where it is.
And they put pretty girls on the set.
Now, Google put a positive spin on this.
Well, speaking of letdowns, Senator Conroy, wanting to poo-poo any particular...
Two spools start rotating in opposite directions.
That's
yes.
The one. That's the one.
Not a good look.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, 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 hello. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron at the microphone.
this week. You're listening to your favourite technology podcast, your favourite technology radio program, with a little bit of humour, some anecdotes, and some friendly interjections from the panellists. Graham, how are you this week?
Good, thanks, Dr. Ron.
Excellent. Graham Callaghan, of course, the ever-present, ever-knowing of all things technical. And we also
too far.
Oh, well, we also have the inimitable Macophile himself, Justin Dunlop.
G'day, Dr. Ron. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We're putting in apologies for Andrew. Now, Andrew has a medical emergency that he has to attend to with his family, so we hope everyone gets well soon, Andrew, and sorry that you couldn't be here. But I think this is the first time in years that Andrew hasn't hosted the program.
It's a while, yeah.
It was you and I, Graham, I think last time, we're up at the old radio station.
Yep.
In Burwood.
That's right. Andrew was off having fun chasing hidden radio transmitters somewhere in the next state across.
He was. He was at Mount Gambier. Correct. So he's not with us tonight. So we will.
Yes.
The show must go on, as they say in the show business and in the industry, regardless. So tonight, all sorts of good stuff to talk about. It's been a busy week in technology. We've got plenty to go on with, even in Andrew's absence. Now, if you're listening to us live, you can watch us on Ustream, ustream.tv/TechTalkRadioAU. You can also chat to me, you can chat to Graham, and you can chat to Justin. The address is chat.techtalkradio.com.au. And if you want to catch up with the latest goings-on and look at the show notes and discuss things that you listen to during the week, forum.techtalkradio.com.au is also online for your information and browsing entertainment. Have I forgotten any? I don't think I have. They're all, if you can't get in touch with us in one of those ways, then
you're in trouble.
You shouldn't be listening.
All the ways to contact us are available on the website at www.techtalkradio.com.au, and that's the best place to start if you didn't catch any of what we said.
It is the best place to start. We've also got Twitter links, we've got blogs, and we've got an email address. Our email address is feedback@techtalkradio.com.au, so feel free to drop us a line there.
Speaking of feedback,
JD, what feedback do you have for us this week?
I was wondering if you had any.
Oh, look, I've always got feedback. Don't you worry about that. I've got truckloads of feedback. Have you guys got any opening business? Let me have a look at the opening business that I have. I've got plenty. Now, we have had some communications during the week, and they have been from, firstly, Peter H. Oz, who's a forum user. And Peter says, Telstra have introduced a 3-month contract on telephone connections. In the past, you could connect a line for $59, assuming it was a previously connected line, what Telstra calls an intact, with no contract. This was handy when you just moved into a new address and wished to connect ADSL2 or naked ADSL2 with a third-party provider, for example, Optus, Exitel or iiNet. And now, if you disconnect within 3 months, there is a $100 fee, says Peter. This $159 total, so the disconnection fee plus the connection fee, which amounts to $159, is called a temporary connection. Peter says they've cleverly avoided using the words contract and early disconnection fee. Cheeky buggers, he says. Also, seeing as most ADSL1 contracts are 6 months due to Telstra's terms and conditions on for their wholesale customers, you'll be stuck on a 6-month ADSL1 contract plus Telstra line rental before upgrading to ADSL2 or naked ADSL2 and kissing Telstra goodbye. Have I mentioned just how much Telstra sucks? Oh, now, Peter, them's fighting words, but you do have a point there. We've long just come to be accustomed to Telstra intacts or Telstra having phone lines which are connected to houses. And if we move houses, you've always got a phone line there. It may not be active. You might have dial tone there, but you can't actually make phone calls on it.
Yep.
And if you want to get anything connected, you do have to sign up, as Peter says. Graham, you've got a number of Telstra services at your residence.
I think only two at the moment, and one that's been disconnected that would be an intact, like you say.
Ah, so if you want to liven that up at any point in time, you can.
Yeah, and in fact, I did that when I changed ISPs, internet service providers.
So presumably they can just make changes from the telephone exchange or from their computers.
Yeah, they did it the same day. I rang them up. I said, look, I've got this old line that's been disconnected. I just want it reconnected. And I think it was within half an hour I rang it and it rang.
That's good.
And they just gave me a new number for it.
That's
so
good. It makes sense for them. If somebody disconnects a service, it's just going to take time and money and personnel for them to actually send someone to a telephone exchange and unplug it all. So all I do is leave everything from a hardware point of view,
and just
intact and
disable
existing
it in software.
Just disable it in software. Mm.
So how does this work with the naked DSL offers? Do you still need to have some telco connect your phone in order for the copper to be alive, or how does that all work?
You still need a telco to connect your phone. You need to have a phone line there.
And you but if you've got an intact disconnected service like we're talking about, then you could just order naked DSL straight on that?
Yes, you can.
Okay, so the difference here is if you want Telstra to install a phone line for you to actually put the copper into your house, you have to sign up for a minimum 3 months. Is that the issue here?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm trying to just paraphrase here what Peter's got. It sounds like that's not the case. Telstra want to liven up the line, make the service active for a minimum of 3 months. Or if you disconnect within 3 months, he's saying there's a $100 fee. Now, another forum user, Sean O'Reilly, has said the ownership of core and vital telecommunications infrastructure by Telstra has long hamstrung telecommunications internet competition in this country. Very true, Sean. The icing on the cake was the choice of the despisable and despicable Sol Trujillo, CEO of Telstra. Our listeners' words, not ours. On the other hand, in the 1990s, we saw Telstra and Optus both laying their own coaxial cables in the same streets for pay television. This was a misapplication of competition policy. Although I'm concerned about the debt our federal government is racking up, I'm glad it's taking a strong stance against a recalcitrant Telstra in regards to the National Broadband Network. Brackets, NBN brackets.
Now, what we have to do, and this is something that's been annoying a lot of us that are aware of this stuff, it's annoyed us for years, that a private company owned the copper phone line all the way up to the first telephone socket inside your house.
Yes.
And, you know, that even though other providers should be able to provide services over that line, the physical line itself is owned not by the government like it used to be, but by a private company. At least they sold it off. Mm. Now, this is a lesson that we need to learn for the National Broadband Network, that fibre connection to your home that they put in with the new NBN, that's got to stay open to competition.
In public hands.
In public hands, that's right.
GD on the forum says, I have an HP iPac PDA. It runs the Windows mobile operating system. Does anyone know of software which will back up the programs and data, similar to the way Norton's Ghost does for ordinary PCs?
I've actually replied to him already.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
Good work, Jade. We'll move on then. Oh, no, you better tell us your response.
So certainly from my point of view, when I used to use an XDA2, Microsoft ActiveSync, which is pretty much standard, you can get it from the Microsoft download pages, actually has a backup and restore function, and you can select which applications it backs up, and it'll back up your data as well. So it's not like Ghost, which is what GD was looking for, something that takes an entire image of the machine.
But the end result is pretty much the same?
Pretty much the same. The only difference would be if you damage the firmware, so the code that actually makes your PDA work, if you damage that, you're in trouble, because it doesn't replicate that. But certainly the software that you might buy...
That firmware doesn't change. If you reapply the latest firmware from iPac...
Well, it depends what you're doing to your PDA at the time.
Oh.
The reason I was using it back then was I kept on reflashing the firmware to get newer and better things. So if you're doing that sort of thing and you mess up, then you might be in strife.
You're a hacker, JD. Normal people aren't going to be doing that. So you're not a normal person, are you?
I can't be a hacker using a Mac, can I? But in terms of backing up your expensive applications that you've purchased, presumably online, I purchased a lot of mine online, it'll back those up so that you can restore them back to your PDA if you do a system restore, so it's blank when you get it running.
Yep.
Restore your applications, put your data back on, and then you can sync and do whatever to keep it up to date.
Don't forget that you might also want to back up separately just by doing a copy, things like memory cards or whatever that might be plugged into it.
In fact, it used to give you an option to back up memory cards as well.
Oh, there you go.
But
okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's not quite a Ghost solution, but it's the effect, unless you're doing something a little bit odd, the effect is pretty much the same.
I would have thought that with a PDA, it would be normal to just have a sync application.
Yeah, well, that's what ActiveSync is, but ActiveSync has built into it this backup functionality.
As well?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. The last time I used something like that was when I used to have a little Palm Pilot back in the bad old days, and you just drop it in the cradle and hit the sync button and off it went.
Yep.
Did it all, but I haven't used anything like that for a while.
Mm.
A Palm 3C, I think it was, I had. Mm. It was one of the colour ones. Very exciting.
Interestingly enough, if there's iPhone followers out there, they probably already know this, but when you do your synchronise to your iPhone, it actually backs up the entire phone every time you do that.
Okay, so
that's kind of interesting.
That's iTunes does that when your iPhone... Yeah, okay.
Very good. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron here is your host for this week. We've also got Graham and Justin. maintaining the momentum on the panel. Come and join us in the chat room, chat.techtalkradio.com.au. Come and join Stryker and Brad and Warlock and all the usuals are there. TARDIS3's there, everybody. Now, Yahoo Microsoft Alliance faces many obstacles.
Now, there's an alliance?
And there is an
there
alliance.
There is. It was big news.
All right. It took Microsoft and Yahoo several years to find common ground, said IT News during the week, on the best way to team up on the internet search market.
We've reported on these rumours on again, off again for quite a while.
We have. So
it pops up every few months.
Is this something that Google should be worried about, Graeme?
No.
No? Should Google be worried about anything? The partnership
Apparently Google have got to be worried about the App Store, but we can talk about that later.
All right, we'll talk about that later. The partnership announced on Wednesday last week seeks to challenge the dominance of the big G. But executives at Yahoo and Microsoft acknowledge that building a search powerhouse will be a multi-year effort. In a business where staying ahead of the competition, not playing catch-up, is critical. Now, Microsoft's been gaining a little bit of ground with Bing.com.
Yeah.
And I've noticed a couple of times, I've installed or upgraded Internet Explorer on people's computers.
Yep, and where it used to say live search, it now says Bing.
That's exactly what it says. Now it says Bing.com, typing your query here. I thought, yep. Oh, yeah, there it is.
Or if you mistype a URL, it decides to help you by taking you to Bing.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, 8 does that, does it?
Yes.
Unless you've changed the default search provider.
Yeah, which I thought I had, but yeah, okay. Oh, there you go.
Very good. Okay, so we've now got that starting to find its way onto users' desktops, especially people who may have just very recently upgraded IE8. And we did speak last week or the week before about upgrading to IE8 anyway, if you're using Microsoft Windows operating system, even if you don't use Internet Explorer as your browser of choice, it's important to load all those updates.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you get files which are necessary for the normal and safe functioning of your computer, for your operating system.
Yep.
All right, so now we're getting IE8 installed. We're getting things, as JD's saying, defaulting to using Bing.com. How far have they got to go, though, to catch up with Google?
I would have thought still a fairly long way. I would suspect that their aim here would be that if you take Google is so far out in front, that what you do is if you roll up all the also-rans into one ball and try and make that whole conglomerate run a credible second. I think it
did. Apparently there's a 10-year deal here. Under the terms of a 10-year deal, search on Yahoo's websites will be generated by Microsoft's new Bing search engine. Mm. Microsoft will license Yahoo's search technology, allowing it to integrate certain aspects of it into Bing.
Of course, the whole business here is, from our point of view, from the user's point of view, it's all about search. And it's all about how we find things. So Bing's got to get to be the go-to place the way, you know, I mean, we use it in the language. We just say we Google something when we mean we're going to search for it.
We don't say we're going to Bing it.
Definitely not.
No,
you don't hear that. So, but from the company's point of view, this is both Google and Microsoft and Yahoo that it's not about search; it's about advertising.
That's right. That's what they want to attract readers and users for.
So, you know, if they can convince us to Bing things, you know,
we'll be Binging.
I don't know.
We won't be Googling.
But I mean, Xerox, I don't know, you guys probably know better than me, but I don't think Xerox is the leading photocopier manufacturer anymore, yet everyone still talks
still
about
Xerox. Things.
You're still Xerox things, that's true.
You still carry around your coldies in the Esky.
So I wonder if people actually do use Bing or Yahoo or any of the other search engine providers will still refer to it as Googling anyway.
Just Google this in Yahoo.
Yeah.
Just Bing this in Google for us. Yeah, it's going to get very confusing. New home buyers fight Telstra lock-in. Politicians, ISPs and analysts are calling on the federal government to legislate against exclusive deals that lock homeowners in new housing estates into Telstra's broadband and phone services. Maybe we should have chatted about this after we were chatting about all that flaming on our forum. The deals are being reviewed by the federal government, and IT News understands and reported last week deals are also being reviewed by Telstra. A Telstra spokesperson was unable to comment at the time of the publication. Yeah, so everything's going to get pre-cabled. If you have a new housing estate, you're going to have the electricity company is going to pre-cable it, maybe, I think, underground in a lot of places now, so you don't have big telephone poles and power poles out the front of your house. You're going to have the water mains put in, sewerage put in, you're going to have all those sorts of utilities, gas, and you're going to have the telephone cables pre-cabled into the street and into your house.
Yep, and broadband service already provided on those cables.
But who owns all that?
Yes, Telstra.
Telstra.
Into their contract, no doubt.
So if you buy a house, does that mean that you're automatically a Telstra customer? you've got Telstra cable coming into your house. You pick up the phone, you've got dial tone, you dial any number other than 000, and it says, for information about this service, please call Telstra on, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens?
Presume so.
Hmm. What about new fibre to the home? Presumably we'll start seeing fibre run into a lot of these sorts of housing estates.
And that'll be the interesting thing, particularly as we were saying before, if the National Broadband Network doesn't duplicate infrastructure, it augments existing infrastructure, but you happen to be the unlucky ones, in this case, that are sitting in a housing estate that Telstra installed, does that mean you're locked to them and not the myriad of other providers on the broadband network?
Very likely it would.
Adam Turner in our chat room says that this is quite interesting, and Internode is also doing some new estates.
Yes.
But it's open, so these people will be the new gen pair gain victims. Yes.
Mm.
So next generation networks like this, in this media release from IT News, it says Telstra's Velocity and NextG, these sorts of next generation networks are not subject to the same access framework set out in the Trade Practices Act.
Mm.
Telstra's been able to shut out its retail competitors out of new housing estates across Australia by entering into exclusive arrangements with developers in return for rolling out fibre in their estates.
Well, you would hope that if they had a captive audience and they had all these houses and they had all the cabling pre-done, that's going to save them a lot of costs in terms of configuring things and not having to go in and put different settings to different lines and all that sort of stuff. You would hope the cost would be nice and cheap for these users, wouldn't you?
You hope so. It all comes back to having a common infrastructure that everybody can access.
Mm.
Doesn't it? And then making the...
Yes. What's the bet it doesn't work that way, though?
Well,
I haven't seen any special pages on Telstra saying, if you happen to live in these areas, you've got a different cost.
No, well, they're not going to advertise it widely, I suppose, are they?
Mm. There you go. There you go. The retail service exclusivity is set out in clauses in the terms and conditions of Telstra's Velocity product. Telstra shall own the network infrastructure, the terms and conditions state. The developer must not use or permit anyone else to use the network infrastructure. Ah. Some home buyers claim to have been unaware these terms would restrict them to Telstra when they bought into the estate.
Yeah.
It's a bit rude, isn't it? If I move into a new housing estate, I don't want to have to use Virgin for my mobile phone.
It's almost something access. That if you're searching for a new house and you're into IT, and anyone listening to this show I would imagine is, you'd almost have to put it on your checklist to check what restrictions there are around
Absolutely.
Internet or broadband access from the house you're about to buy.
Yeah, well, it's already advisable because of the ADSL technology to check how close you are to your telephone exchange and what telephone exchange you're on.
And Jen and I have been looking for houses recently, and in fact, it wasn't on our checklist, so...
Well, there you go.
There you go. We'll have to add that
to
the list.
Yeah, broadband choice are very good for looking up addresses versus exchanges to find out where your exchange is and what technologies are available.
If you're in Australia, yeah, broadbandchoice.com.au. You can type in a telephone number. It'll tell you what's available in the area.
So, yeah, that's one tip. I used to be... Do you remember... Back when you and I were into radio, Dr. Ron.
Oh, that's a while ago.
Isn't this radio?
different kinds of radio. We used to think about being in a prime location on the top of a hill or on a ridge where we had good spot to put our radio antennas.
We used to say, this is a good radio house.
That's right.
It's in a good spot.
Yeah.
And I know that...
But now it's how close are you to your broadband?
This is exactly it. And Andrew, when he was moving offices recently, when I say recently, in the last 18 months, couple of years... He was shopping around for office suites, and he was looking at the telephone exchanges.
Oh, absolutely.
And he was seeing what ISPs had what equipment in what telephone exchanges, so he could have... That was one of the top criteria for him as to where he was going to move.
Well, of course, because his business relies on being able to deliver content over the internet, so that's
would
absolutely
be interesting
vital.
To know, you know, from a commercial point of view, and Andrew might be able to advise us when he's in next week, is whether that makes a difference to the rental of the property.
I don't think they're the real estate agents are that
Have
savvy.
Cottoned onto it yet?
No, they're not that switched on.
Well, maybe
no.
We can help them there.
You could. Well, yeah, you never know. You might be able to monopolise on it. You might be able to say, oh, yeah, this is a pretty crappy office and I don't like what you're asking for it. I'll give you half. And
the
agent might go, yeah, sold. And secretly you're rubbing your hands together. Say, oh, look, I'm right next door to a telephone exchange.
You might see it start to appear, you know, excellent broadband speeds or something, as, you know, listed on the real estate tickets.
Yeah. Yes, close to public transport.
Yep.
We're on the national broadband network.
Fast broadband.
Yeah. Fast broadband.
Yep.
Customer parking.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. That'd be good. I'd like to see that. Be very good. Graham, do you use Gmail?
Yes.
You do. Justin?
No.
No, I use Gmail.
I don't use it as my primary mail, but I do use it.
I use it as my primary mail.
Hmm.
It's working very well for me.
So do you actually publicise your Gmail address, or do you use Gmail to operate another email account?
I use Gmail to operate another email account.
Yeah, people don't realise you can do that.
It's very clever. So I can represent myself as a different user at a different domain with a totally different email address.
Yep.
And I can get all my email in there. I can access it from anywhere. I can send through it through the web interface. I can send through its own mail server. They use authenticated sending. So you use a username and password to send.
Oh, yeah. This is a problem a lot of people have, where if you've got a notebook that you travel around and it's connected to different networks at different times, that sometimes it's difficult to send mail if you're not on your own network.
That's right.
Because you can't connect to your right SMTP server.
Correct. But in this case, Gmail, if you connect to Gmail, if you've got access to the internet, you can send from anywhere, anytime. Google has tweaked its Gmail for business users.
Ah.
So this is only a couple of weeks after it took the word beta off the end of the product.
Yeah, and they've changed it already.
Google's made a much-needed update to its Gmail service, says IT News, designed to make it more appealing to business users. Many users employ Gmail as a hub to send messages as though they are from another account. Guilty, such as Microsoft Outlook. Yes, there we are. But their Gmail username is shown in the sender field of the message as well as the displayed from address. This is true. So without getting too technical, it displays my email address like drron@, and then it has in brackets on behalf of My Gmail user at gmail.com. This meant that the mail recipient is given access to the sender's personal Gmail address. Well, that's true. Google has now said that instead of using Gmail servers to send the message, it will use the servers at the sender's other email address to prevent the two from being shown.
So it'll route send mail through your account, your other account.
Yes, something along those lines. Gmail software engineer Emmanuel Pellero said in a blog post, "We heard your request for another option that wouldn't show the on behalf of text, and we heard that request loud and clear. Now there's a new option that does just that. Users wanting to turn on the new feature should go to the Gmail accounts page under settings, click edit info from the send mail as section, and then the option to use your other email provider's SMTP service." Well, I thought this was for, when it said for business users, you had to sign up to a business account, but it sounds like they're doing it for free for everyone.
Excellent.
Definitely be worth having a look at that. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
It sounds like for those who are used to working in an Exchange environment with Exchange and Outlook, it sounds like the difference between send on behalf of and send as. So, yeah, for those who are familiar with that terminology. So, yeah, it really does look like it comes from your preferred address rather than your Gmail address.
Very good, Google. I'm impressed. So a couple of weeks after we lose the beta tag, we've already got some worthwhile tweaks happening.
Definitely be having a play with that one.
Let us know if that works for you, or if it doesn't work, or if they've botched it completely, or if it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yep, post your email headers
on
the forum.
Yeah. Please do. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au, or you can post them on the forum at forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Hacked Windows 7 appears on file sharing sites. I despaired when I saw
this
headline.
Don't do it.
Graham, what's this all about? You haven't got any notes there, but I know you can prattle this off the top of your head without any assistance.
Okay, this is for people who want Windows 7 and don't want to pay for it.
Bad luck.
Yeah, you go to those same sorts of sites where you download the latest movie from, and you download Windows 7, including a method of getting around their activation.
And the question, of course, is it the real Windows 7, or someone put other stuff in there?
Yep.
That's what you've got to worry about if you do that sort of stuff.
That's number one thing you've got to worry about. But number two thing you've got to worry about is, even if it is untampered with and it's relatively clean, what's going to happen is that if it's available on the file sharing sites, Microsoft are going to get wind of it. They're going to block you from receiving the updates. So your machine is going to end up being unprotected against any security problems that they find in Windows 7 as it goes. It won't get fixed, and your computer will, absolute, I guarantee it, get infected with all kinds of malware, Trojans. It'll be sending out spam to everybody under the sun, and it'll be going, it'll be a disaster. Don't do it. Not worth it.
And if you remember, I think it was one of the Apple suites, I've forgotten which one, I think it was Life 09 or something like that, was released to one of these types of sites, and one of the hackers had actually put a Trojan in it. So
there
if you downloaded it, you instantly infected your Mac at the time, And, you know, there was some conspiracy theories at the time that Apple actually did it to prevent people from pirating it. But nevertheless, never a good idea to download that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Warlock in our chat room agrees with you, Graham. It's most likely the real Windows 7, but Microsoft says don't download it in case it's got viri.
Viri, plural.
Is that the plural of viruses? Of virus?
I think it's one attempt at a plural of virus. I'm not sure it's the one I would use.
It's a good attempt, Warlock, at any rate. Microsoft says we are aware of reports of hacks that attempt to circumvent activation and validation in Windows 7.
Yep.
We can assure customers that Microsoft is committed to protecting them while we're committed to doing things with stakeholders on a go-forward basis. That's good. We strongly advise customers not to download Windows 7 from unauthorized sources. Well, everybody, the panel agrees.
Look, once upon a time for private use, it wasn't such a problem to use unofficial software of this kind, but these days it's just not worth the risk. It's just too much trouble. I know you're going to have to shell out some big bucks to Microsoft, but it's worth it to keep your machine running.
Do it for peace of mind.
Yeah.
And if the hip pocket damage is really that much of an issue for you, have a look at Ubuntu.
Exactly right.
There you go. Goomblar.
Who?
Goomblar mutates into Spam Beast. Do they know how to write these headlines, don't they? An Australian web hosting company has reported that zombie machines infected with the Goomblar exploit.
Yep,
Goomblar, which is exactly, I just like saying Goomblar. I'm going to say it again. The Goomblar exploit.
That's a good name.
Have reawoken. The zombie machines have reawoken and are being used to propagate spam. Aussie HQ, which owns the Joombar brand, reports that tens of thousands of shared hosting customers have been infected by the malware. The Goomblar exploit apparently exploded onto the web in mid-May. The malware searched for file transfer protocol or FTP details stored on or being typed into client systems and used these details to log into web servers to inject the index accounts of the site with an invisible iframe. Oh, that's nasty. The iframe then infects any client machine surfing to the website and propagates itself should that client machine also access a web server via FTP. How prevalent is this sort of stuff?
So this has been around for a while.
Yeah, it has.
And everyone thought it was dormant, I gather, and
it's reappeared.
Mm. And the stories about these sorts of threats go around every now and then, and they just serve as a reminder for exactly what we were talking about before. Use genuine software, keep it up to date, do your security patches,
and update your virus
have
software.
A decent antivirus solution on. And, we've talked to the guys from Kaspersky before. They're a good option, but there's other free ones and alternatives out there. There's plenty of ways to protect your machine. Hit the forums and hit our forum if you like, and, you can get some good advice. Lock your machine down.
Lock it down. Do your updates. That's what's important.
Yep, because otherwise you're seriously part of the problem with in particular, the spam problem.
JD, Linux.
Yes.
You've had some experience with Linux.
We all have, I think, in this room.
Have you ever fed back to the community by way of a financial donation?
That particular community, well, it depends.
It's okay if you say no, I haven't.
If you call buying a commercial Linux product supporting the community, then I have.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting topic in itself, isn't it? You're supporting a distribution.
I've certainly purchased some Red Hat commercial products, enterprise products before.
Yep.
Would you?
In fact, so is Graham, was the same one.
If the Linux Foundation was to release a credit card,
right,
which supported the Linux Foundation, would you get a Visa card with tucks on it?
Oh, gee, I don't know.
Tell everyone.
It looks very pretty.
It does. I'll hold it up to the camera there. I can't see what I'm. That's looking, but there you go. Tell us what tucks is.
Tux is the
Hold it
Linux,
up a bit higher, Ron. Those on the web chat can't see it.
Tux is the logo that the Linux community uses. It's basically a stylized drawing of a penguin. So, and the penguin's name is Tux, T-U-X.
I reckon my oldest child might actually do that because when he was just born, his first little hat had a Tux logo on it.
Oh, dear, Justin. Didn't have an apple on it.
No, it didn't. It had tax on it at the time.
There's lots of ways to support the open source community. I mean, just simply using the software, and when you find something wrong, tell somebody about it. Submitting bug reports is helpful.
Now, I've done that, and I've written how-tos on how to install and use.
There you go.
Things.
So you're a contributor. You're not a financial contributor, but you're contributing to the project.
I'm not sure how many people actually use my advice, but anyway.
Well, no, but it lots and lots of contributions like that add up to something significant. And, yeah, some people want to contribute by donating hardware to developers or so on. You know, the developer might need a particular type of machine to build their software on or something like that. And some people might be interested in buying mugs or hats or whatever. You've obviously bought a hat with a tux on it. That probably the money for that probably went back to
in a size triple zero at the time
to one of the projects. And so, this is another extension of the same thing. I would consider it. I would think about it.
So how's this actually going to support them? What's the deal?
The way this supports them, Justin, is the foundation receives $50 for every account activation. Mm-hmm. In place of rewards points or rebates that you usually get these days, every time you use the Visa card, a percentage goes to the Linux Foundation.
Okay.
Media release says, or APC says, that's actually a cool thing, considering you don't have to change your buying habits to lend a hand. In the long term, simply holding a Linux Foundation credit card could be a way of paying your annual membership dues.
Yeah, that fee that the merchants pay when you use a credit card, that goes back to somebody. In this case, that fee would go, at least in part, back to
the Linux Foundation.
The Linux Foundation.
How good's that?
Yeah.
I like that. That's a good idea. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au, or you can join us in the chat if you're listening live. We'll be coming up to a break shortly. Let's just have a quick talk about telecommunications regulation change is closer. Andrew's been good enough to print out all the notes here tonight and give us a rundown. He's done all the hard work. All we have to do is just sit here and talk about things, which is what we'd be doing anyway if the microphones weren't on. We'd be sitting here talking about all the latest guff. The federal government is one step closer to introducing legislative changes to the nation's failed telecommunications regulatory regime.
Oh, that's a bold statement.
It is. Thanks, Australian IT. You've done well. It's received more than 30 submissions detailing the legal framework needed to ensure that its national broadband network project does not flounder.
Yep.
Flounder further? No, it doesn't have the word further there. The 30-plus, no adverbs by Australian IT. The 30-plus submissions from stakeholders, including Telstra, Optus, Macquarie Telecom, as well as Competitive Carriers Coalition and Business Council of Australia, were received before last week's deadline. The legislative submissions are closely tied to the government's regulatory discussion paper, released on April 7, and are expected to advise on legislation needed to frame the access regime for the NBN. They're worried about it going west, aren't they?
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yes.
Suppose you don't want to invest that much money.
Is it too little too late at this point? Or?
Well, they haven't really spent a great deal. They've committed money, but they haven't actually spent anything as far as I'm aware. There was a tender announced recently, but that doesn't
Buy some the national broadband network rollout that was supposed to be starting now in Tasmania, and they started it by putting out a tender to actually buy the cable.
So I suppose it makes sense to get the legislation right, but you would have thought they would have done this maybe last year or even earlier to make sure that it was all ready to go. But anyway, I suppose prior to spending money, legislation's good. Protect the public money and copper and so forth?
As long as that's what the legislation is actually doing.
Yes, that's what it achieves. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au. You're listening to Dr. Ron and Graham and Justin on Tech Talk Radio. We'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
Tell us about your new toy. This
is the one that occupies the room.
This is gadget of the year, this one.
I just want to click an Xe and have this work.
So you've got a workaround for the Android market now for your Android.
How long is that in viewing time?
About 84 minutes.
The only option is to buy it outright then.
It is, it really is.
So you unplugged all the fax machines?
Yeah, go on.
I'll tell you though, that you've got to be careful doing that. Some people get very narky.
Internet villain of the year.
And the moral of the story is backup.
Backups, for goodness sake.
This is along the lines of the AFL with drug cheats, isn't it?
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. This is Dr. Ron, your host for this week's episode. Also, we have Graham on the panel and Justin. Andrew sends his apologies. He's got a note. He sent the note in here with all his equipment and all. He's done all the hard work.
He has all the
rundown and all the show notes, all the equipment, all the complicated bits of wires and pieces of technology that make the show go to air every week.
Yep.
He's done a good job. Computer games. Graham, you're not a gamer, really, are you? I've never known you to be a big gamer.
No, not hugely into the games. Every now and then I get hooked on something a bit silly. I can remember sitting up all night playing Warcraft 2, was it?
Yes, Warcraft 2. We whiled away many hours, days, weeks, months, years on that game, didn't we?
Yeah, but no, the latest incarnations, World of Warcraft and all that, haven't grabbed me.
Mm. What about snappy, quick video games that you can just play in? Because when you actually start to play a video game, if it's long and involved and complicated, you're making a commitment. The next half hour of your life or the next day of your life is going to be spent playing this game. Or you can just play something quickly on your iPhone, can't you, Justin?
You can indeed. I used to be a fan of the old arcade games, so Galaga and Space Invaders when they first came out.
Galaga. That's what we need to know about. Adam Turner he's a man. He is many things to many different people. He's a respected independent IT journalist, and he has this week's A View from the Couch. He's talking to us all about the current state of play with video games. Here's Adam.
When it comes to computer games, a lot of people are looking for snack-sized entertainment. Food and computer games have a lot in common. Some days you're looking to sit down to a hearty and substantial three-course meal. Other times you just want to grab a quick bite before you run out the door. Sometimes you spend all day at work dreaming about the big night out you've been saving up for. Other times you're standing in your pajamas by the light of an open fridge looking for a midnight snack before bed. Casual gaming has taken off over the last few years. It's a term roughly defined as games which require no long-term commitment or special skills to play. Some people say casual gaming is what's wrong with the games industry. Others say it's what's saving the games industry. I'd say it's probably a bit of both. Now, PopCap is the champion of casual gaming with classics such as Peggle and Bejeweled. They're cheap, simple, quick, and surprisingly addictive. They're the French fries of the gaming world. At the other end of the scale, you've got a games house such as Blizzard, with immersive classics such as Warcraft, Starcraft, and of course the online World of Warcraft. These are the 12-course banquets of gaming, exquisite, time-consuming experiences to be savoured. I'd also argue that The Sims is closer to a banquet than a snack. It's aimed at the casual gaming demographic, but it's certainly not a game you can dip into quickly and just play for a few minutes. I'm sure someone has already written a thesis on why casual gaming has become so popular, but I'd say there are a few key factors at play. The first is simply a time commitment. The more responsibilities you have in your life, the harder it is to find and to justify the time to play an epic game like World of Warcraft. The average Australian gamer might be 30 years old, but they probably can't get away with gaming all night and sleeping all day like they did when they were 19. Or was that just me? Anyone who's tried to slay a level 60 Orc Warrior with one hand whilst changing a DEFCON 1 nappy with the other hand knows what I'm talking about. I think the rise of casual gaming has a lot to do with the new generation of gaming hardware. Smartphones such as the iPhone, consoles like the Wii, and handheld games like the Nintendo DS are no longer targeted at kids. They're aimed at 20-somethings and 30-somethings looking to grab a few minutes of relaxation. People can kid themselves into thinking they're buying an iPhone as a business tool or that the Wii is for the kids. Perhaps they'll get the Wii Fit or the Nike Plus iPhone kit and convince themselves they're on a health kick. I wonder how long it takes before they abandon jogging for Mario Kart or Peggle. Like I said, casual gaming is not necessarily a bad thing. Stress-related illnesses, both mental and physical, are certainly taking their toll these days. If a few minutes vegging out in front of a game reduces the chance of you dropping dead of a heart attack or going postal at work, then that's certainly a good thing. Of course, you'd be better off combining this with exercise and a healthy diet, so I'm told. So where does this leave the 12-course banquet games from the likes of Blizzard? I'd say there's room for them to coexist, just as McDonald's hasn't run all the 5-star restaurants out of business. I enjoy a few laps of Mario Kart on the Wii with my kids or playing Crash Kart on the iPhone, but I'm still looking forward to indulging myself with StarCraft 2 on the computer. When it comes to gaming, I'm aiming for a balanced diet.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
One of the users in our chat room says Leisure Suit Larry was awesome. Do you remember Leisure Suit Larry in the Land of the Lounge Lizards?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I used to play that. Yeah, Graham's doing a Leisure Suit Larry solo. Excellent. Isn't that terrific?
Well, I had a quick game of tennis on the Wii before I came out to the show tonight.
Did you?
Hmm.
Did you play it against anyone, or is it against the computer?
No, against the machine.
Against the machine.
I lost one match and won the other, so that was okay.
Oh, good. Oh, very good. I used to play Warcraft, as we've discussed. StarCraft was very big. After StarCraft, we had all the Wolfenstein.
That's right, Wolfenstein.
The Wolfenstein 3D. Saga. And then the Return to Castle Wolfenstein. That was a great game.
Yeah, and you can get that for the iPhone at the moment, I think.
You're kidding. No. Return to Castle Wolfenstein for
the
iPhone.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. That we were playing that on really old machines.
Well, Wolfenstein was a bit of a landmark game because it was one of the first that had that 3D rendering engine built in where you could actually move around in three dimensions, or two dimensions,
yep.
Really, but it was the first one of its kind, wasn't it?
Was that first-person shooter that they, the genre that, is so big and has got so complex and so advanced these days.
Yep.
And
I wasted a lot of time on Duke Nukem.
Duke Nukem, yeah, I used to play Duke Nukem on the PC. All of the, then there was Quake and Doom, all of those sorts of first-person shooters, and it was always against like aliens and people in foreign armies and things. There's always lots of blood and guts and violence and gore. Never did me any harm, I don't think, that I'm aware of. Oh, now JD's showing me Wolfenstein 3D Classic. Achtung, it's on his iPhone. I wouldn't have believed that unless you showed me. Adding it up to the webcam now. Isn't that fantastic? All right, and yes, someone else has mentioned there's something about vampires, Adam. Thanks for that. Very good. Now, that actually links into our next little article here. It is very nice. Andrew's done a sterling job. Families turn their backs on violent video games. And they're turning their backs on violent video games in record numbers. News.com.au reports that almost one in three video games sold in what's turning out to be another record year for games is family-friendly. Oh, almost one in three. So less than one in three is family-friendly.
Yeah.
All right. For every fighting game sold, seven family-friendly titles are being snapped up, the Herald Sun reports. In 2006, family games rated third with a 13% share of the market, a long way behind sports with 24%. I would have thought
sports is family.
Friendly. Yeah. Shooter and fighting games at 15%. Yes. And action at 17%. Wow, the trend to buy music and dance games, party games and puzzle games could be a reaction against street violence.
And there's all these Guitar Heroes and dancing games for the Wii and various other platforms.
And
they're really
at
big.
Your place, there's always a pile of quiz show type games.
You can't get through my place without getting commandeered by the Hugs and Kisses to play on the beat. What is it? The one that she hits the buzzer with?
I don't know what
Buzz.
It's called.
Buzz. Yeah, the Buzz quiz show games. Yeah, they're a lot of fun. They're great fun when you've got friends around and family around.
Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because sort of these gaming consoles, and this article, I think the photo there looks like it's a Wii Fit device that they're playing with in news.com.
The subtitle's Rejecting Violence.
Yep.
Crikey.
Now, these are all things that are in the lounge room.
Yes.
So there's parental control and supervision. So it makes sense that they're likely to be more family-friendly because there's an element of control.
Justin, psychologist Dr. Janet Hall says families are being more responsible in guiding their children towards more social games. Going on from what you're saying.
Yeah, and in our case, we've got it's the only gaming console we've got, and we've got the Wii Sports Pack that you get traditionally if you're getting the sort of the hunting for a bargain. But it comes with a boxing game. Now, with our little ones, we're sort of against them learning how to box just at the moment because they'll use it for evil and not for good. Compulsion for them to, can't we do boxing? Can't we do boxing? Now, that might well be because we keep on saying no.
Dad, I want to punch someone.
That's right. mind you, they do like bowling, which is great. We have a good bowling night Friday nights and various other nights of the week. And they like baseball and so forth, although not very Australian, admittedly. But, they're so hooked on, can we do boxing?
Isn't that amazing? Are they getting that pressure from,
I don't know,
the childcare groups or school that they're in? Or
look, I don't think so. It's probably because Jen and I have been saying, no, you can't. I think that's probably the reaction. But it's interesting that they're attracted to the more violent games than the family-oriented ones.
I used to love those, the violent games. The more aliens you can blow up with your grenade launchers and stuff, hey, the better. You get green slime flying around. And
remember there was a version of Carmageddon that got banned because it was too violent? It showed too much blood and guts?
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
I played it, yeah.
It was a good game, though.
Graham used to play that. I remember Graham playing Carmageddon telling me about it. He had to do all these despicable things. But I think it's all a bit of fun if it's kept in context.
Red bloody tyre tracks down the road.
That's right. Yeah. From driving over people.
Mm.
Oh, dear. Yes.
Cows.
You used to drive over cows, did you?
Yeah, there were cows that you could run into as well, yeah.
So that was the Australian version where you didn't run over people, you ran over wildstock in
skates. Oh, you ran over people as well.
Very good.
What's the games market worth, do you reckon, in the last 6 months in Australia? Without looking, Graham, come on.
Gazillions, I don't know.
Bajillions. $840 million worth of games have been snapped up by Aussies in the last 6 months. The figure is on track to eclipse the $2 billion that Australians splashed on video games last year, according to industry sources. Mm. That's not
and
bad.
You've just got to look at the number of games that are on the iPhone App Store and probably on the Android App Store too, I would imagine. There are heaps of them.
Mm.
And some of them are copies of the old arcade-type games or Wolfenstein, as we mentioned before. But a lot of them are novel little games that are puzzle solvers or variations on a theme, Tetris and those sorts of things, but in 3D or using crystals or whatever. So
I've got on my iGoogle page this little coloured block puzzle thing that you have to click on and blocks disappear and you've got to get rid of all the blocks and it's... Yeah.
They're addictive, aren't they?
They are very, very addictive.
How long does that take to play if you're going to play a game? Commit to playing a game?
Just 2 or 3 minutes.
2 or 3 minutes of your life?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a good point that Adam raises. He's brought up in the view from the couch there. When you start playing a game, you are making a time commitment.
Mm.
Either you're going to commit 2 or 3 minutes or 5 minutes while you're waiting for a tram.
Yep.
Or you're waiting on hold to talk to someone at a telco.
It's the 2 or 3 minutes while I wait for something to download or wait for something to burn to disk or something like that.
Yep. Or you embark on an epic Warcraft level against somebody else and you're committing the next 3, 4, 5, 6 hours to playing this game.
Mm.
And I know people at work that have said, I'm going home tonight to play, you know, whatever it is, World of Warcraft.
Yeah, that's right. And that's all they will do is play that one session. Yeah, it's staggering, isn't it, when you think about it?
Yeah, and that's where I haven't been able to get into those games is because of the hours and hours. Not you might commit several hours to a mission or a whatever you call it. What do you call it in World of Warcraft?
I have no idea.
A campaign
or something. But leading up to that, you've got to commit many, many hours over days or weeks building up your character and learning the ropes of playing the game and all that sort of stuff.
You do?
It's a big commitment.
It's a big commitment. Ozstar.
Satellite TV.
Regional
provider?
Satellite television.
Yeah.
Well done. Ozstar is... This was actually mentioned in the news, I think. Ozstar is to make a major marketing push this year to promote the launch of more than 20 new channels, more interactive services, including on-demand viewing and a new high-definition version of its set-top box.
Okay.
The regional pay TV operator reported last week a net profit after tax of $35.5 million for the 6 months to June, up from a $7.6 million loss in the previous comparable period. You have to be happy with that.
Yeah, that's a big turnaround.
Yeah. The chief executive, Mr. Porter, John Porter, attributed the results to a turnaround in consumer sentiment and some positive impact from the federal government's economic stimulus program.
Yep, people have gone and bought their big screen flat TV and hung it on the wall and said, now, what am I going to watch?
And I dare say...
Need some high-def content.
There's certainly lots of ads in the Melbourne TV media around Foxtel IQ and CQ or whatever the products are called, around the global financial crisis, saying that people aren't prepared to go out and spend money at the cinema, but they'll spend their money on a subscription to something. So Ozstar's probably in the same boat.
That sounds fair enough to me. And, yeah, why not? You can have lots of... good content, the high def cable channels from, I presume, the likes of National Geographic and BBC World and those sorts of places. We've had them on the upgraded Foxtel when they went to added all the high def channels and added their IQ2 and all that a little while back. So that's good that's coming to the satellite and regional providers as well.
They're also talking about a catch up service.
catch up.
Yep, so you can actually go online if you miss a program. So similar to what the ABC are doing with
iView.
Mm-hmm. So they're going to slowly roll that sort of a service out, make that available to their customers, which is good. It's just good that they're keeping up with the technology.
Yeah, excellent.
Yes. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Dr. On. You also have Graham on the panel and Justin on the panel. Andrew's put in his apologies for this evening. We're about to go to a quick break, but coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about how big is it, if it's not a personal question, and electrifying ideas for a smarter power grid.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Twitter? We do. Why not follow us? For the Tech Talk Radio Twitter feed, follow TTR2008 or visit techtalkradio.com.au to see what all the presenters are currently tweeting.
Before we get to the rundown this week, Dr. Ron.
Oh, yeah, you know.
It'll help keep you warm on a cold Melbourne night.
Now, they've actually been pulled off US telly.
So chances are it may be a nice marriage of technology and provider.
I'm fed up with this "you're not living in the right country" stuff on the internet. That's not the way the internet works.
Oh, well, you will work for the government. Yeah.
I'd be hoping they'd be refunding that pretty quick,
we're
smart.
We're in 3 meg hell, buddy. What are you?
I'm on 8 meg. 16 or 17 megabits per second.
Suck it up, princess.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio, Australia's loveliest technology radio show.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. This is Dr. Ron, your host for this week and this week only. Graham and Justin are also on the panel. Andrew sends his apologies. Thanks for listening. You can talk to us live on the chat. You can send us messages via email, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. You can watch us on Ustream. You can log on to the forum. You can do just about anything you like with this technology.
You can even listen to the radio.
You can listen to the radio.
That's a thought.
Good old-fashioned FM, future modulation. You can hear us in Cairns. You can hear us in Brisbane. You can hear us in New Zealand.
Melbourne.
You can hear us in Melbourne. You can hear us all over the shop. You can hear us in Adelaide on FM. That's a special narrowband service in Adelaide.
Okay.
More details on the forum. If you're interested, forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Something which I'm going to make up as I go along here, certainly not in the notes in front of me. Hard rubbish collections. Graham, you live
fantastic computer collector like me.
You live near me, Graham. Geographically speaking, have you got a hard rubbish collection at the moment?
Oh, I don't think so. But you live in one of those special places. You live on the other side of the border.
I'm in a special place.
People your side of the road have a hard rubbish collection, put out their stuff every 6 months.
Yes.
And people our side of the road don't have them that often.
Don't you?
No.
How often do you have them? Once a year?
Oh, if that, I can't remember.
Or annually.
Yeah.
How do you get rid of your disused technology?
Yeah. Well, we just have to store them up for longer.
How do you acquire new junk?
Yes.
Justin?
Get in trouble when we do that.
Yes, you do.
I do that a lot, yes.
Get into trouble or acquire a new drunk or both. Junk or both. Acquire a new drunk? I think that's what I am at the moment. I'm feeling a bit junk. Now, have you got a hard rubbish collection at the moment? You live just down the road too.
Negative.
No.
We had one a few weeks ago.
Are you the sort of person that fits into the category of A, do you look forward to the hard rubbish collection because you like pitching stuff out, taking the opportunity to clean up? B, you look forward to the hard rubbish collection because you like trolling the streets, looking at what crap people have thrown out because it doesn't work anymore and grabbing it and taking it home anyway? Well, C, do you not like hard rubbish collections because there's always cars stopping in the street and picking up junk? Or D, none of the above?
A and B, actually. I enjoy getting rid of rubbish that I don't want,
yes,
like garden refuge and building supplies and things that are sort of loitering in the backyard.
Yep.
And if there happens to be any Apple products around, I'm rather partial to picking them up.
So do you generally have a net gain of equipment or a net gain of space?
Gain of equipment, probably.
I used to be in that category. I like to think that I have a net gain of space now. I put out a lot of computer junk this week.
Ooh.
Some of it, a lot of it is gone, much to my... Well, I'm not really amazed. I can't say I'm amazed. I'm just... It strikes me as being bizarre.
What do people do with those Pentium 1s?
Well, that's right. There's a reason why I'm putting out a box of Isobus parallel port cards. Why they're of no use to man nor beast. Why do people take these things? What could they possibly be doing with them? I don't understand. There are a lot of monitors out in the hard rubbish.
There is. I've noticed an awful lot of TVs. Adam Turner on the chat's been saying the same thing, and an amazing TV on the Nature Strip, he says there. Lots of cathode ray tubes going out. Again, probably the RUD incentive. Everyone's run out and bought their LCD or their plasma tellies. And it's time to get rid of the old one, which is a real shame.
Well, it is a shame because I agree with you, Justin. There's a lot of stuff that I've seen just as I've been driving around the last week or so. Fantastic-looking televisions, which probably 5 or 6 or 10 years ago, people would have paid thousands and thousands of dollars for. And they're just out in the junk now. Mm. Same with monitors. A lot of what would have been very expensive big monitors, like 17-inch, 19-inch, big Sony monitors, CRTs.
Yep.
And you think
people would have spent a lot of money. Replaced them with flat panels.
People have replaced them with flat panels, and they consider it to be junk or not usable anymore.
And heavy, too.
They're very heavy.
I take up desk space. So you can understand why people are converting, but it's just such a shame that useful technology is just getting scrapped.
Exactly.
So what's the alternative?
The alternative?
What are we going to do with this stuff if we're not going to put it out on the hard rubbish collection?
Well, we can't keep it. The problem is that I've learned the lesson in life that you only have a finite amount of space on this planet, and you have to use that space wisely, and you just can't keep everything forever.
There's always space for more technology.
Oh, Justin, I used to think that way. TARDIS3 in the chat room says that Dr. Ron needs to collect more hard disk drives from a hard... Oh, it's a question. Dr. Ron needs to collect more disk drives from a hard rubbish collection? TARDIS, I'm glad you asked. I've brought some show and tell for you.
I've seen it. It's amazing.
Now, I know it's going to be difficult to see this on radio, but we'll put a photograph of it on the forum, perhaps. I'll hold it up to the camera there. I was throwing out a lot of stuff, and I found this, and I couldn't bring myself to throw this out. This is a hard disk. On the side, it says Seagate Technology. It's a model ST412.
IBM branded on the front, though, so, yeah.
It's a genuine, out of a PS2 machine, probably.
I have no idea.
Could well be.
I have no idea.
But for those of you who can't see the stream, so we're talking about a 5.5-inch wide device. So the size of your CD players.
And it's double full height. Yeah, it's what we used to call full height. Now, your normal CD drive or DVD drive in your computer is what we call half height. So it's twice as high as your DVD drive. It's a real monster.
And it's absolutely chock-a-block of circuit boards. The hard drive itself takes up half of that space, and the driver boards are the other half. So
the circuit
it's
board,
a massive machine.
The circuit board is what we call solid state, which means it's not surface mounts, no surface mount technology.
It's got the old dual inline package chips on it. It hasn't got any of the very large-scale integration chips.
It's breaking my arm. Take it.
That's quite remarkable. And a lot of those are just standard gates, you know, 74S74.
I figure...
Ooh, nerd alert.
74LS14N.
Graham's reading off the components on it. So I figure
they're just standard logic gates.
Does this belong in the museum or does it belong in the rubbish bin?
Do we know how big it is? It's probably like 5 megabytes?
It's probably a megabyte or something.
I'll find out.
My first computer had a 40 megabyte hard disk in it.
No, this is not that big.
And it's not that big. This is probably more like a 10 megabyte if that.
I had a 40 that was a half height, but this is much older than that.
Yes.
I've got 5s that are that size that still work.
There you go. Mm. Things you find. Graham's going to do some. He's going to bing the numbers on the chipsets, trying to find out what they were or what they are.
So what do you do with that?
Well, this is what I want to know. Is why I've brought it in for show and tell.
I think you give it to a museum.
Does it go into a museum?
There can't be that many of them left.
Or would a museum look at it and go, what the hell's this, Dr. Ron?
It's a 10 megabyte.
I was right.
10 megabyte.
It is. You found it, have you?
Yeah. Made in about 1991.
So that's not all that long ago. 1991's not that long ago.
Sorry, 1981, I mean. That's a long time ago. 1981.
That makes a bit more sense. So that would have been state of the art in 1981.
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah.
How big, what's the capacity of it?
10 megabytes.
Wow.
So your average computer has about that much RAM now.
No.
Your high-end workstation does, sorry.
Yeah. No.
That's megabytes, not gigabytes.
Oh, no,
megabytes.
Hundreds of times.
We're talking like what when your digital camera takes a photograph, the photo wouldn't fit on that hard disk.
That's right, yes.
Mm. Amazing, isn't it?
Yes, this is about a quarter the size of the podcast version of this show.
So you need four of them to fit the podcaster. Imagine lugging that. Those are in on your belt just to
now,
listen
Warlock's
to a podcast.
Just pointed out, the Australian Computer News Museum in New South Wales, in Sydney,
yes,
is actually having trouble getting funding, and I've actually been part of their project at times.
Oh, this is really upsetting, actually.
It is. Yeah. They had a huge warehouse. They can't afford the space anymore, and the last time I heard, they were parting out their collection to enthusiasts and assistants to try to salvage them and look after them in isolation, which is really sad.
Yeah. So there is a need to preserve some of this technology too, because a lot of this technology goes along with storage formats and data.
Now, we talked about the moon landing the other day.
Yeah.
And the fact that you'd need a very special type of tape drive to actually view the video.
Yeah. And in fact, the type of tape drive that wouldn't even exist anymore. And I was hearing about other information. There was a scientist who had an experiment that flew attached to the Apollo lunar module that was measuring dust levels. And NASA sent him all the data retrieved from his experiment. They sent it on these big data tapes that, you see them in old movies, the big refrigerator-sized reel-to-reel tape drives. They sent him all his data on those sorts of tapes. And now that they're going back to the moon, they want to look at this data to find out more information about the dust they're going to...
A slightly different analysis than they would have done back then.
And they were wanting to go back to the raw data. NASA lost the original tapes in the same way that they lost the moon landing videotapes.
They're not good at holding on to tapes.
NASA are very bad at keeping their tapes. This guy had been given copies of the tapes. NASA had shipped them over, and he still had them, but no one could find a tape drive that would play them. Now, this is where, it's great to have a museum and to see the history of things and to see devices like this monster hard drive here that you can barely get anything on. But let alone that, there's going to be a whole, what are we up to now in computer technology? Decades and decades worth of records and history that's lost because it was kept electronically on formats that can no longer be read.
That's very right. And there's a couple of groups that I've been associated with that moved to electronic records in the 80s and early 90s who have made decisions to move platforms. So, for example, they were in Novell very early on. They've moved across. Well, in fact, we helped them move across to a Linux platform, and now they're running Windows servers. And essentially, they made the decision some time ago that anything prior to a particular changeover they weren't going to keep. So they've got no access to that data. So you can imagine the local council historical societies that go back and look at the written records of deaths and marriages and news articles of the time. If a newspaper or a council decides we're just not going to keep anything that's older than 20 years old or 30 years old that the law might require, quite possibly in the future years when you go to look at the history of the town or your family or whatever, it'll just be missing.
That's right. Yeah, once upon a time, businesses would have kept their accounting records in written ledgers, and historians, a lot of it would have got destroyed, but there would be the odd one that would survive, and historians would be able to look at that and see what went on, see what sort of businesses were being run. All that sort of information now is going to be just completely and utterly lost.
Which is very sad.
If there's information on that disk there that I want to retrieve, how do I retrieve it?
You'd have to get an MFM device, which is the format that hard drive was probably built for.
What does MFM stand for?
I can't remember anymore. It's been
modified frequency modulation. It's the name of the way it was encoded onto the disk.
Wow.
The data was encoded onto the disk. And there was a special controller using cables of a type that we no longer use.
Is that not the disk controller that's attached to it?
That's not the full controller. That's only the hardware-level controller. There's another controller card that attaches to that that's as complicated again.
Crikey.
It didn't just plug into the IDE bus like modern ones do. It had a big controller card of its own. If we wanted to recover the data off this, it would be quite a challenge. I had a customer not long ago who had some historical data that they'd done a survey. They wanted to see what the previous survey's results was that were done 10 years ago or something.
Yep.
And they had the results in a Lotus 1-2-3 file on a 5.25-inch floppy disk.
a Lotus 1-2-3. That's a spreadsheet program.
Yep. Prior to Excel.
Huge before Excel. Yep. It was what everybody used to compile data before Excel became popular.
And it was on a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk.
Yep.
Which I've probably just thrown out about 50 of those in the hard rubbish and probably thrown out about 500 3 1/2 inch floppy disks.
There you go.
The more interesting thing, because I've actually got machines that will still read all of this sort of stuff at home, the more interesting thing is, in fact, that those disks are now getting demagnetized and their surfaces are breaking up. So even if you've got the media, quite often it doesn't work anyway.
That's like the problem that we've all been faced with Super 8 film or movies and home movies, things like that. We need to get them off the media that they're on before they fade, before it degrades, Justin, exactly, and get it into something new, something that'll keep it.
And then in a few years' time, we won't have DVD players anymore because they'll all be Blu-ray players.
Yeah.
And then a few years after that, we won't have Blu-ray players, we'll have something else, and we'll have to keep changing the formats as we go along. Right.
Now, there's a few people on the chat talking about computer collections and so forth. I actually have a collection of Apple computers. We've probably talked about that before. One of the other interesting things about the hardware from about 20 years ago is that when they started using capacitors and they were doing production line, they started using really cheap capacitors to get the cost down. What I'm finding is all my equipment from the early 90s, the capacitors are leaking, damaging the motherboards, and so that technology, no matter what you want to do to restore it, actually has to be physically repaired and maintained regularly.
Absolutely,
which is a huge task that I'm not quite up to at the moment. So,
it's a big job for somebody. When you connect all these hard disks together and you connect all the computers together, you have a network.
You do.
And if you connect enough networks together, you have a really big international network, like an internet. How big's the internet, Graham? How many websites are there?
All of them.
You're right, that's a good answer.
It's approaching
the internet
infinity,
is everything,
surely.
Yes, it must be.
Microsoft's Bing team puts the amount of web pages at over 1 trillion. And Google has already indexed more than 1 trillion discrete web addresses. There are more addresses than there are people on Earth. The current global population...
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
No, the current global population stands at more than 6.7 billion. That means there are about 150 web addresses for every person... in the world.
Which is interesting when you consider probably half of the people of the world don't have access to the internet anyway.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yep.
Yeah, this article from news.com.au this week talking about the size of the internet. Australia does pretty well with its representation in terms of the number of people that are on the internet that have access. Around about nearly 81% of Australians have access to the internet, about 17 million people. China is a rather poor number, only 22%. India, 7.1% of people in India have access to the internet.
And they're the two most populous nations, of course. So.
And of course, that means that they're a huge proportion of world of internet users, even if it's only 7% of their population.
That's right. Yeah, like 7% of India's population at 81 million.
Yeah.
So how big can it get?
Well, we've only just scratched the surface, haven't we?
So that's IP version 4 can support that, and we're about to move to version 6. Because of capacity problems.
To a new addressing system. Mm. That's right. We also said just before the last break, we're going to quickly talk about electrifying ideas for a smart power grid. Electricity is everywhere around us. It powers machines that run our society and our interwebs, yet we seldom think more about it than the effort it takes to flick a switch. But a nationwide project underway to lift the IQ of our dumb power grid to make our homes and workplaces better able to manage the power they consume is poised to sweep away that complacency. And the biggest change to power generation, distribution and use since Nikola Tesla was a boy gazing up at lightning storms in the night sky. That's a big call. Australia's electricity companies and governments are rolling out smart networks to replace those powering the nation for the past century. We've spoken in the past about the telephone network, the copper cable that comes to your house. In terms of the physical cable, not much has changed in 100 years.
No.
No. What about the power industry? Not much has changed there in 100 years either, has it?
No, not at a fundamental level. There's still big, huge generating stations concentrated in certain places. There's a couple of huge coal mines out to the east of Melbourne where they plonked a couple of power generators right beside the coal mine, conveniently, and that's where all our power comes from.
What they're proposing here is that electromechanical power meters, which we use at the moment, with patent histories harking back to 1872,
yes.
will be replaced by smart meters loaded with scores of features and potential to reduce and provide usage information.
Oh, yes. Now, someone came and knocked on my door the other day and said they needed to sight one of our meters that's obscured. and they mentioned that they were going to upgrade it to a digital meter at some point.
There you go. The digital meters are the only visible component in this upgrade. Distributors are installing thousands of sensors at substations and on Australia's streets to alert them to events that could harm the grid. And the payday for resellers, power industry insiders say, is to bring IT smarts to the back offices of energy companies so they can secure and make sense of the welter of data about to come their way.
Well, one of the things that's going to have to happen with the power grid, or that I think is going to happen with the power grid, and people can correct me if I'm wrong.
What, broadband?
Is no broadband over power, thank you very much. We chucked that out a while back. We discredited that well and truly, thank you very much. Don't get me started.
The contempt it deserved, yes.
Is decentralisation, actually, so that you're not generating all your power, you know, at the generator that's beside the coal mine or the generator that's beside the dam if you're in places using hydropower or, you know, wherever those big centralised generators are, that in fact you can have power being fed into and taken out of the grid at all kinds of places around the grid. So if you set up solar cells on the roof of your house and you have a big storage battery under your house and some controlling electronics, you can actually sell electricity going back out into the grid as well as use electricity off the grid, depending on when it's to your advantage to do so and when it's to the grid's advantage to do so.
And that's the sort of intelligence they're talking about.
Yeah, and we touched on this a couple of weeks ago where I mentioned electric cars we were talking about and whether an electric car would have the smarts to be able to charge its battery when electricity is cheap, and then perhaps if you're not using the car, sell some of that electricity back to the grid when electricity is expensive, when there's high demand and they need a bit more power.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Justin and Graham are with you tonight. Coming up after the break, iPhone vulnerabilities. Justin, we'll be picking your brain there, and Adobe releases security updates.
Listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
Internet Explorer 8 officially came out of beta during the course of the week.
Images depicting a man vomiting outside a London pub were removed from the site.
Give it a try if you haven't.
I got stuck by our own spam filter.
Yeah, it's good like that. It works well.
There is nothing that would surprise me with what kids do online.
With many years with experience.
Entertaining.
You're an idiot. It's only three words.
Informative.
These new hard drives are all solid state.
Independent.
They need constant poking.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tricky thing, the English language.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
Tech Talk Radio.
Dr. Ron back with you on Tech Talk Radio, and Graham and Justin are your willing and able panellists. Andrew sends his apologies this week. Hope you're enjoying the program. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au or join us on the chat if you're listening live. Or you can have a look at the forum, forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Look at Ustream, you can look at Twitter. There's even the odd Facebook account floating around. No excuses not to stay in touch with us. There's also no changes to Skype's IPO plans, according to eBay. eBay shrugged off speculation that its planned spin-off of Skype could be in danger, given an ongoing dispute over the technology used in the online telephone unit and new plans to develop proprietary software. The company said in the statement, "Our plans to separate Skype have not changed." eBay said it would not comment beyond a regulatory filing made this week. Dr. Ron needs to go back to English 101, doesn't he?
To newsreader school.
Back to newsreader school. Do you know how long it takes me to record the news each week? When I say stupid things like that, and I sit there in front of the microphone and I say things like, damn, bother,
yes,
gosh.
And then you have to...
I jump up and down, stamp my feet, bang the desk.
I've recorded the news and I do the same thing when I have to do it.
I can't believe I said filing when I meant to say filing.
They don't trust me with the news. Tells you something, doesn't it?
The whole process has to start again. Skype, eBay, yes, well, does anyone here use Skype?
Yes.
What do you use it for?
Usually talking to other people in the States on Skype. So there's some Mac collectors over there that I've talked to. In fact, I've been on their podcast via Skype.
Right. Now, the most recent experience I've had with Skype is testing out Skype Mobile. the beta or the light version of Skype.
And we
the,
had a bit of a play Android. After one of the shows out the back. In fact, I think there's some twit pics there from a couple of weeks ago where we did a bit of a Skype network to see what we could work and not make work.
There are. No, there are. And Adam has actually blogged and ranted and viewed from the couch a lot about Skype recent times and mobile IP telephony from handsets.
Yeah, now it's largely, and Adam's commented on this elsewhere, and we've probably chatted as well, but it's largely blocked from the mobile networks, mobile data networks, because the carriers don't want competition necessarily over their phone plans. But in the case of the iPhone, you can certainly get a hack installed that allows Skype to work over Next-G and other 3G products in Australia, but it does require a jailbroken phone.
All right. Well, in this news release, eBay said they've shrugged off the speculation about their spin-off of Skype. In their filing, eBay acknowledged that the new software it was working on had no guarantee of success. Oh, well, I'm glad that everyone's positive and looking upwards at eBay. That's a good attitude to have. eBay said that Skype has begun to develop alternative software to that licensed. However, such software development may not be successful, may result in loss of functionality or customers.
And it's kind of interesting when Skype was spun off from its original providers, it's kind of interesting that the license agreement or the license transfer didn't include the core components of the telephony behind Skype.
Yes.
Which is what this is all about. So it's just a bizarre turn of events, really.
From IP telephony to iPhones, Justin, the iPhone is vulnerable to hacker attacks, according to researchers.
Well, it was. And so was Android and a few other things. So, yes, apparently, if you SMS'd... Yes, allegedly. Well, no, actually, it's more than alleged.
It's been
a demonstration of it at one of the Black seminars recently.
Whoops.
So, apparently, you could hack into the iPhone and the Android phone at one point by SMSing some code, supposedly without the users knowing. I don't quite know how you get an SMS without knowing about it. Nevertheless, you could insert some code in the iPhone and prevent it from talking to its network and doing various other things. So that's been patched. So those of you out there with an iPhone, if you update to version 3.0.1, that fixes the vulnerability. Doesn't do anything else. That's all it fixes. And if you're using a jailbroken iPhone, apparently you can still jailbreak it with the former application. So the 3.0 jailbreak will still work. But if you're like me and jailbroken iPhone, watch this space. The jailbreak team are apparently looking at a way of upgrading to the new versions of iPhone software without having to lose your jailbreak and download all your software again. So if you're happy for the vulnerability to wait a week or two, watch this space.
That's what in some other developer communities would be called backporting.
Yes.
So they take the fix from the new version and apply it to the old version.
That's right.
Hey, is it true true that Google Voice has been banned from the iPhone?
Now, this is kind of interesting. I was reading about this today. Yes, it has. The App Store's banned it. And in fact, if you have a bit of a Google, you can find the story online, and we'll find the link and put it in the show notes. But
Apple.
The Google developer.
Yeah, blame Google.
No. The Google developer has rung Apple and said why, and they've published the transcript of their conversation.
Really? He's rung up and he said, WTF, Apple, why have you banned my application store?
In summary, it says, you've had it for a month for testing and you didn't raise any issues. You've had it online for 4 months and you haven't pulled it. Why now? And so the FCC over in America, so the competition watchdogs, are now investigating Apple, AT&T and Google to find out what the heck's going on.
Thanks, Warlock, for giving me the heads up there in the chat room. Mm. Adobe releases security updates. The critical vulnerability in Adobe Acrobat Reader, Air, AIR and Flash Player has been addressed with the new security updates from Adobe. It doesn't say fixed, it says it's been addressed. The vulnerability, which was identified last week, affected all four programs on Windows, Mac, OS X and Linux. Some attacks had already been reported against Windows versions of Reader. Graham, do you know anything about this Adobe vulnerability?
I haven't read about the specific vulnerability, but what I do know is that a huge proportion of the web pages that you go and visit will use the Flash Player technology or the Air technology. And if they're vulnerable, then all it will take is for somebody to create an advertisement, submit it to some website that you visit,
and they could use that vulnerability to install some software on your computer without your knowledge. The same thing, they could send you a special PDF document, which would open in what's called now Adobe Reader, which is what we used to call Acrobat Reader.
Yes.
So it's going to be very important for the security of your machine to go and get these updates. So if you don't have to be using the full if you're using the full commercial version of Acrobat to create PDF documents, you must update that as well. But even if you're just an ordinary home PC user, you do almost certainly have some of this software installed on your machine. You have Acrobat Reader and you have the Flash Player. Yeah, go to the Adobe website, adobe.com, and make sure you get the updates.
I use a program called a third-party program called Qt PDF to create PDF files.
That's great.
Yeah, it's like a printer driver. Install and you go file print. And you print a Qt PDF, and it writes a PDF file.
Yep, and there's a lot of those programs about, and they're very good. But, in some environments, it's seen as an advantage to use the Adobe PDF Creator to get extra functionality and extra work out of it. So, yeah.
Tech Talk Radio, Gadget, Website, and Oddspot are coming up next.
Suffering Succotash, this has to be the best technology show on the internet. Tech Talk Radio.
The 43-year-old claims he was looking for evidence of UFOs and aliens.
Well, did NASA get hacked as well?
Yeah, absolutely. No,
really?
If you need high speed and high quality at the same time, you need a much more powerful transmitter.
It automatically offered me the latest Optus configuration file.
How long did they take to get back to you? And how did they get back to you?
By the time you finished your cheeseburger, it was full too hard and you drove away.
That's right.
Somebody else in the world will have had the same problem.
Latitude's everything to me. Yeah. I like knowing Dr. Ron is at any particular hour of the day. Or my wife, for that matter.
But they're both of them together.
Hang on a minute. What does that mean?
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics.
Cool.
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my hole.
Now, everyone remembers Maxwell Smart in Get Smart. Well, this week's gadget is a real-life wristwatch phone. Not a shoe phone, better than that, a wristwatch phone.
Oh, like Dick Tracy.
That's right. Oh, Dick Tracy, of course.
Nice.
It's the LG GD910 watch phone. T3 Magazine says, who didn't want a watch phone when they were a kid? Well, I did. I still do. Now, you can have one.
Is this real?
Yeah, apparently.
Apparently.
So, a small portion of childhood dreams can come true, courtesy of LG's new watch phone. Shown off at the CES conference recently, it'll be hitting the shops soon. It's packed with 3G and a 1.43-inch touchscreen. Now, you'd have to have small fingers to use that touchscreen, I'm thinking, but nevertheless, you don't actually have to talk into the phone. You use it via a Bluetooth earpiece, of course, using current technology. So, earpiece, phone in your watch. Don't need to carry anything on your belt. I think it's fantastic. For more details, go to www.lg.com.au.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Are you familiar, Graham and Justin, with Dilbertisms? Like cube farm, blame storming, seagull management, and percussive maintenance? Someone's gone to a great deal of trouble to compile an online dictionary of net-savvy slang where you can browse, add, edit, and update your favourite words.
Now,
is it
just from
Dilbertisms? No, it's from anything and everything. The website of the week is urbandictionary.com. As it sounds, one word, urbandictionary.com. There are over 4 million definitions which have been added to the Urban Dictionary since 1999. There's a Word of the Day feature. You can even get coffee mugs and T-shirts printed with your favourite Urban Dictionary definitions. Examples include a bachelor wash, which is defined as a quick soap-free rinse of a plate, cup or utensil, which has just been used.
Oh, I know about that. I've seen that happen.
We've all been there. We've all had a snappy bachelor wash. And pulling a palin. Pulling the palin's when you quit when the going gets tough, or a bizarre move that will damn future career ambitions for higher office. That's a bit of fun. Have a look at that. Our website of the week is www.urbandictionary.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Don't ask! For God's sakes, don't ask!
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Now, we're a fan of Twitter on this show. We all tweet from time to time.
Yes, some TikTok of us, Radio tweets.
Some of us more than others.
I tweet. Graham tweeted once.
Occasionally
yeah.
And every once in a while when I'm on holidays.
You tweet?
I'll tweet.
Yes.
It's a fair thing when I'm away, which is all good. Well, what else can you use Twitter for? Well, here's a novel idea. A US writer failed to get a publisher for his novel.
A novel idea. That's clever.
A novel idea. You like that? So he's putting his novel on Twitter.
Yes.
Do you see a problem here?
You can only put 140 characters there at a time.
140 characters at a time. So it'd be like the ultimate soap opera. You'd have 140 characters. Tune in for the next important episode. So Matt Stewart said it would take about 3,700 tweets to transmit all 480,000 characters in the French Revolution, as admitted, would weed through all my tweets. That's very cool.
There might be a reason why he couldn't find a publisher.
Yeah, his jokes aren't all that good. In a blog post, the novel's author, Matt Shepard, said...
That might be my joke, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, okay. My immediate reaction, were I in your shoes, would be incredulity. I agree. Who reads long-form literature on Twitter? Who reads long-form anything online? Well, that's pretty true. If you have to scroll more than one page, you sort of lose interest online, don't you?
So each tweet would be like, dot, 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 she said.
Yes.
He said, don't look at me in that tone of voice. She then put something in the microwave oven and turned the...
No, you're way too long. You're way over 140 characters already.
That'd be infuriating.
Yes.
And if someone decided to retweet a particularly interesting bit of it, you'd be in strife because you'd lose half the message, as I want to do. So if you want to have a look at his blog post...
If you want to prove him wrong,
or prove him wrong,
no one will look at it.
And read the whole thing through, so this is a bit of a challenge, go to twitter.com/thefrenchrev, one word.
Is that the name of his novel, The French Revolution?
The French Revolution.
French Rev. Right.
Good grief.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Dr. Ron. You've also been enjoying the company of Graham and Justin. Apologies from Andrew. We hope you've enjoyed the program. Remember, as always, feedback at techtalkradio.com.au. You can send us an email. You can look at forum posts, forum.techtalkradio.com.au. As we alluded to before, as Justin alluded to, you can even follow us on Twitter. All the details are posted there on the forum. It's been great. Thank you very much for your company this week. And Andrew, I'm sure, will be back as usual next week hosting the program. Until then, it's bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Justin Dunlop, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations around Australia that take the show. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9818 2756 or visit our website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.